next talk, we're going to listen to Karsten Bittrich and Stephanie Todd. And they are going to tell you about taking extremely precise measurements at the Large Hadron Collider. So conquering large numbers at the LHC by Karsten and Stephanie, PhD students from TU Dresden and members of the ATLAS team at CERN. Please welcome them.
Thanks a lot. We are pleased to be here and take the opportunity to share some insight into our everyday work and, most importantly, into the enthusiasm that we have for our day-to-day work. We would like to talk about large numbers in the context of particle collider experiments at the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC. That is not working. Okay, so what are we actually doing? We are doing data analysis of particle collisions within the ATLAS collaboration at CERN at the LHC. In this talk, we want to show you different aspects of how we are doing this and give you an overview of the, going from the ordinary hydrogen bottle to the final data analysis of proton-proton collisions. And let's start to unfurl the sentence from the behind. To first motivate why we are actually doing particle collisions. Why are we seeking for even higher energies? Because the LHC was built as a particle collider that reaches unprecedented energies. And there is a simple explanation. It's the Einstein relation of energy and mass, E equals mc squared, c being the speed of light. And this is a very large number, as you all know. And this means in order to produce decent mass at a collider, you need a lot of energy. And in order to produce even more massive particles, you need even more energy. And this is exactly why we are doing particle collisions and why we built the LHC, because it allows us to unravel the mysteries of the universe, how it was created, maybe also find out what it is made of. Okay. So we're studying collisions. We have brought a shopping list. What are the ingredients to do this? So first of all, we need protons with a lot of energy. Then we need a place where the protons collide. And we need a huge detector to look at these collisions, to snapshot these. And then finally, we need the tools and the infrastructure to analyze the collision data. Let's just start with the first point, and to show you how we get the protons to travel nearly the speed of light in an accelerator. And I've brought you a short video for this. And we just start the video and set the scene. We are at the border between France and Switzerland at the CERN lab, which hosts the Large Hadron Collider, a circular collider of 27 kilometers circumference. You can see this here. The airport is right next to this, so just that you have a scale. But the CERN does not only host the LHC, but a complex of multiple particle colliders, as you can see here. And it all starts with a bottle of hydrogen, where we get our protons from. And we extract the protons from the hydrogen atoms and then accelerate them using electrical fields. Right. After that, they are passed to the first circular device, which is the booster. And here you can already see one of the major things, crucial things that happen here. So you have four stages in this collider. And here they get accelerated for the first time. And then they get passed on to the next bigger collider, and then to the next bigger collider. And this is what you will see here. And most important thing is here that you see that the proton beam is not continuous. Right, so you have large bunches with a lot of protons. While the second circular collider is further accelerating the proton, it also splits these larger bunches into many small bunches. These bunches then contain roughly 10 to the 11 protons, a very large number, and have a bunch spacing, so-called, of 25 nanoseconds. Right, so here you can see the injection already in the larger accelerator complex, and we accumulate a lot of bunches until we have roughly 3,000 of these bunches, right? And We even accelerate them further because we need a lot of energy. And once we have the 3,000 bunches, we can inject them into the Large Hadron Collider in opposing directions so that you can allow for collisions. And in the LHC, they reach their final energy of 6.5 tera electron volt. And they travel 20 minutes to reach their final energy. Okay, so now we have protons that are in bunches, 3,000 of them, 3,000 of them with a bunch spacing of 25 nanoseconds. And we are ready to deliver this beam that we have created in the LHC to the experiments that are taking place at the LHC. There are four main experiments, one of which is the ATLAS experiment, and Carsten will tell you a little bit more about this.
Okay, so as Stephanie said, we are part of the ATLAS collaboration, and I would like to show you a bit what the ATLAS detector really does and how we process the data in the ATLAS collaboration. So once we have stable beam in our in the LHC and we have the full energy of the beam, we activate our, the beams, and we activate our detector. So the detector is sensitive, and now we have our first collisions. So the detector was designed not only to be able to reconstruct the paths of particles, but also their energies. And then that mixture helps us in identifying the different types of particles we want to identify, because all of them have different signatures. And we want to store the information of all of these events for later usage so that we can later on try to identify what kind of events happened to cause these outcomes we saw. And this is what we can see here. And these collisions happen every second, 40 million of these collisions happen because you have the 25 nanoseconds bunch spacing. But remember that all of these bunches consist of a huge number of protons. So you have even larger number of proton-proton interactions happening every second. So here in the video we show the 60 million collisions. That was the number the LHC was designed to deliver, however the LHC over-delivered. So it performed really, really well, and now we are roughly at 1 billion proton-proton collisions per second. Remember that around 25 of these happen simultaneously, so we can only measure the overlay of 25 collisions every time. And so, first of all, in our data taking period, we want to consider today, this is the data taking from 2015 and 16, this adds up to 2.5 times 10 to the 15 proton-proton collisions. That's a very large number. We put it here on the slides, and as well, we put a scale in here, and every tick on that scale is a factor of 1,000. So we can really see that we go quite up here. And we have this 2.5 quadrillion events on that scale shown here. Just to get a grasp on that number, so if you imagine to have a huge amount of sugar, of plain table sugar, maybe don't do this as an experiment right now, but if you imagine a huge amount of sugar that would cover the floor of the glass hall in front of that hall, and you would have a layer of roughly 1 centimeter, then each grain of sugar in there would still represent 10,000 events. So that's a really large number. As I said, we cannot really distinguish between the ones that happen simultaneously. So we go down a step already. We have now 10 to the 14 events that could measure. That's the first step, you go down. But we have the problem that each of those events, if you would want to take the data for that, is roughly 1 megabyte. So 1 megabyte events with 10 to the 14 number of events in total, that would be 100 exabytes. At an average rate of 40 terabytes a second. We cannot afford that. So we have to find a way to only find the events we're interested in. We are a bit lucky in there because we have been studying these collisions for decades now. And nowadays we are only interested in the one collisions that are quite rare and very high energetic. So we are only interested in one out of a million events where we have a huge energy and which we haven't studied really before. And we have really a fast triggering system which helps us to make fast decisions to decide whether to store an event or not. The first level of the triggering system is only applies really simple algorithms, so it really only tests subparts of the detector, so it doesn't look at the full detector, only looks at if there's huge energy deposit somewhere or not. And That trigger system is done in hardware, and it accepts events at a rate of roughly 100 kilohertz. So this adds up to a data rate of roughly 100 gigabytes per second, and that is something that we can, so we read out the detector for each of those events, and we have this 100 gigabytes per second, and this we can pass to a huge cluster at CERN, where 30,000 CPU cores process all of these event candidates in parallel. There we have a bit more time, we can take a bit more time, we can try to identify the different particles in there, we can try to construct observables using multiple objects in the event, and using these tighter filters, we can reduce the rate by another factor of 100. And that gives us a final event rate of roughly 1 kilohertz. And this gives you then the data rate of 1 gigabytes per second, which we can comfortably store, and we pass all of that to the CERN data center. So just to recap that, so the first level trigger gives you an event rate of 100 kilohertz that already brings you down. Both of that affects the file size and the events in the same way. And going also the second level trigger, we're going to get down to 1 kilohertz. And then we are at a level where we have roughly 10 to the 9 events already. And so we have already broken down 6 orders of magnitude using these large filters. You might wonder if we introduce a bias if you apply such a filter, if you only look into the events that have the high energy. And what we do to avoid such a bias is to use a limited amount of our bandwidth to essentially store random events. And these random events give us a handle to also have a look at these events which would normally not pass our filters. So now we have all of these events passed to the CERN data center, and Stephanie will tell you a bit more on what we do there.
Exactly. So I have to swap the slides. And yes, so the next step is the data preparation. Once the data comes into the data center, there's one at CERN and also one in Hungary that we are currently using. There are two things that happen. So first of all, we copy our raw data to long-term storage on tape. This is the first thing that happens. And the second thing is the so-called reconstruction. What do we mean by this? And for this, let's just quickly recap how collisions events look like in the detector. We have the two bunches that collide, and while they collide, they leave a burst of particles in the detector, right? But the particles itself are not visible to us and also not visible to the detector. What we can see is the interaction of these particles with the material of the detector. And these leave electrical pulses in the detector, as you can see with the orange boxes here. The aim is now to transform the hits in the detector into a data format that we can use for everyday physics analysis. Let's go a bit more in detail. So what we do to do this. So we go from raw data to physics object. This is the main goal. So first of all, we have to do calibration of energies, of positions, and everything that is measured in the detector. Right, so this is done as a reconstruction step. Then we also have to assess whether the data we have taken is actually good for physics analysis. Let's just give you an example. For example, we have ionization detectors, and there are high voltage lines. And if one of these lines were not operational, then this part of the detector cannot be used, for example. Or if the noise in one of the cells is just too high than what we would expect on average. Then we also mask these cells, and these are then not taken into account for the physics analysis. So we can either flag single events as not good for physics analysis, but we can also flag periods of some minutes already for not being used for data analysis. So this happens from time to time. So we have to basically select the good ones from the bad ones, right? And all these flags, in addition to other data that, for example, the detector operation data, which is, for example, the trigger conditions that Carsten just talked about, we have to store this together with the physics objects into the file, right? And the major part of the reconstruction is the transformation of the detector hits into physics objects, for example, electrons, that you might know. Just to give you an example here, this scheme shows you how, from the detector hits, we reconstruct trajectories in the event. This is done on a sophisticated analysis algorithms that take into account statistical tests to determine which of the hits belongs to the same track. And then you can combine these hits, and then you form a track, right? And this is how we basically reconstruct, for example, tracks in the detector. Then each physics object has attached to it a pattern of directions from the tracks and energy deposits. And this is what we also store into the files, right? The physics of the objects with their features. And this is why the file size increases then slightly again, because we add a lot of data to this already. Then the next thing is that you can already see that the file size is still at 1 petabyte, right? So this is not feasible to analyze this. We just don't have the resources for this. And to now we have to reduce the size of the data. And there are three ways to do this in three columns. So the first way to do is just to reject full single events that are just highlighted here in blue boxes, and you can just remove whole events. What you can also do in the middle row is you can remove certain objects from certain events. And these objects are represented as these colored circles here, right? And then what you can also do is you can remove observable variables that are related to a physics object or that are related to the whole event from the event, right? The first row reduces the number of events in the files, and so also the file size. The second two only reduce the file size, but not the number of events, right? Okay, and these three methods, how do you select these, which objects to keep, which events to keep, and which ones to reject? This is based on a physical meaning, right? So we then, in order to make our physics analysis, we make a two-step approach. First, we make a rough physics selection for that can be used for multiple analysis. So multiple analysis then use the same output from this rough physics selection. And this already reduces, in our case, in the analysis that we are doing in our PhD, reduces the number of events by 1,000 roughly, and linearly so also the file size. This is done by just rejecting single events. And if you do this, the second and the third step already, you further reduce the event size to about 1 terabyte, the file size to about 1 terabyte, right? And then there's another step where you do a physics selection that is analysis specific. So every single analysis has its specific own selection. So our selection is different from any other analysis that is done. Right, and this then further reduces the event size in our case to 140 events in our analysis signal region, and we are left with a file size of about a little bit more than 1 megabyte. These sizes can easily be analyzed on your laptop, while the former ones that I've just, the first step where you have still 1 terabyte of data, you would rather do on a local cluster. Okay, so once we have done this full selection, we have selected 141 events, one of which looks like this. So what you can see here is an event display. You can see the scheme of the detector in blue, red, and greenish. And you can see that this is cut in half, and the beam pipe goes just horizontally through the middle of the scheme, right? What you can also see is the remnants of the collisions, the tracks in the middle of the detector, and then some yellow dots which represent energy deposits in our calorimeters on some parts of the detector. What you can also see are these reconstructed physics objects, and these are most interesting to us. And most interesting to us in our specific analysis are these yellow coned shaped objects. And it is very characteristic for the analysis that we are doing that these cone shape objects are very close to the beam pipe, right? So now I've shown you what such an event could look like, and we have selected the final events that we want to use for our analysis, and Carsten can now go on and tell you how to do this.
Okay, so now we have done all of the hard work, we have prepared all of our data, we have passed this to the physicist. Now let's do physics. So what are the actual questions, the actual conclusions that we want to draw from all of that data? That is one question I would like to answer, and I would like to answer to show you as well how we try to see these conclusions. So let's pick an easy example. The easiest thing you could do is just to count the number of events you observe in your data. That would be the first number to see, and the other one, then you need to compare this to a prediction. So we have predictions for your background processes, and you have predictions for your signal processes. In this easiest of examples, imagine you have a perfect prediction of your background. You know that perfectly to be 7, so you predict to have 7 events in the background, and your signal prediction is 1 event, just to keep it simple. And now you want to draw conclusions from that. So even if the observed number of events perfectly hits your background plus signal prediction, so you observe 8 events in data here, that doesn't mean that you can draw any conclusions from that. So you cannot say here that you observed your signal process just because it fits perfectly to your data. The problem is that the theory that your signal doesn't exist, so your background only theory, is still perfectly compatible with your data. So there's, within statistical uncertainties, the 8 observed events in data are completely fine with the prediction of 7 events. That's like if you imagine that on your way to work every day, you on average observe 7 red electric cars. However, one day you observe 8 red electric cars. You wouldn't say that this must be a strange day and something is completely off, because you know that this is just a statistical fluctuation with no underlying meaning. And the same has to apply here. So we cannot draw any conclusions just from that. So we need to have more information. And that we can do by just not adding up all of the events, but by really looking at each event and trying to see and to get a bit more physical understanding of what really happens in there. And that we do by looking at kinematic distributions. So let's look at the particular one event Stephanie showed here. And let's work through how we do that. So in this particular event, Stephanie showed you these 2 yellowish cones that we're interested in. And now we want to calculate an observable from that. In our case, that just means we want to calculate the invariant mass of these objects. Unless you've been to the Introduction to Quantum Mechanics lecture 2 days ago, probably you don't know what this is. This invariant mass is just the, you can think of this as being the energy you need to produce to these 2 particles. So how much energy do I need to produce these particles in this configuration? And in this case, the energy here we would need is 2.8 tera electron volts, which is a huge number. This is why we are so interested in these events, because we have these 2 very high energetic objects in that case. So we want to look at this kind of events, and here in that case, this event has 2.8 tera electron volts. So now let's visualize this. What we do is to plot this in a histogram, and what you can see here on the x-axis is the observable you want to look at. So in our case, this invariant mass. And on the y-axis, you have the number of events in specific regions of that invariant mass. So I highlighted those different regions here, so you just count how many events are in this green regions, how many are in the yellow, orange, and red ones. The event we had before was comfortably in the red region, so we have our first data entry here. So now if we wait a bit more and we take our data in Atlas, we see all of the other data events coming in, we do all the same procedure for all of those events, and we end up with a distribution like that. And here you see this is the actual distribution that we measured in data in the Atlas measurement. But still, with only the data, you cannot draw any conclusions. So what you again need is some predictions. So for these predictions, what we do is to generate events from our theory. So based from our theory, from our underlying theory, we generate events. And then in order to be able to compare that to data, which has some effects of the detector in it as well, we need to simulate the full detector as well. So we not only need to generate the events, but we need to know how would the reactor, the detector react on these kind of events. And then we pass the generated events through the same chain as we did for the data processing. So we do the same object identification, the same analysis algorithms. And we apply all of them in the same way. So then we know that we can compare the two numbers. And that gives you, however, a bit of a problem in terms of file size, because if you want to have enough statistics so that your final result is not really limited by the number of events that you generated, which would be a bad thing, we have to see how we can reduce our file sizes. So the good thing is that we don't need to generate all possible processes, because only a handful of processes really contribute in our final signal region. So we generate all of them. We generate all of them in a comfortable amount. So here we put roughly 1 million events or something for all background and signal samples. And then we also obviously store the information of the particles that we passed into the detector simulation. So that means that the file size per event is a bit higher. We store more information. And this is why we have a slightly different ratio here, although it's probably quite hard to see. So if you now draw in all of these predictions for the different processes, you have these different colored bars. They are just added on top of each other. So the lowest one, you have all of the background processes. And the orange one on the top is your signal process that you're actually interested in. And now let's do the same exercise before. So your background-only hypothesis is given by the upper end of the yellow bars. This is what you're interested in for the background-only hypothesis. And if you want to look at the signal plus background, you just add your signal again up on this. So you have your signal plus background given by the upper end of the orange bars again. So now what you do is to scale your signal up and you scale it down and you see which one compares fits best to your data, always comparing it to the background-only hypothesis. You always have to compare this to make sure that the background-only is rejected while you keep your signal plus background hypothesis. And then you're back with some scaling of your signal process which fits best to your data. And this is then you observed. It's not yet the final one, because for the final full statistical calculation, we don't have perfect predictions. We need to know how uncertain those are. So for instance, if we simulate our detectors and we would want to compare this to data, we need to make sure that the data, we simulate the detector with the same conditions as we have when we measure our data. But we don't know those conditions because we generate the events before we take our data. So we have to make some assumptions and afterwards correct for any differences. So then you have some correction factors, and also these correction factors have some uncertainties with them. So what you do is to change your calibration of a certain type of object and see what is the effect on your final distribution. So you really pass it again through the full chain of analysis and through the full chain of reconstruction to see what is the effect of the different calibration. And you do that for all kinds of different effects. We have something in the order of 100 different variations that we pass through all of that again. So your file size goes up because all of them we have to store again. This is again roughly a factor of 100 here. And if you combine all of these variations in the end in a proper way, you end up with an uncertainty band like that. And if you have the uncertainty band, you can compare this to data, and then you can really see how much of your signal process has to be there to explain the data. And in this particular example, we were able in this year to claim the observation of this process. So we had a sensitivity of 6 sigma, or more than 6 sigma. We claim an observation as soon as we pass a threshold of 5 sigma. That just means that the probability of observing something like the data distribution, assuming that only the background exists, assuming that you don't have a signal, that the probability for this is something in the order of 10 to the minus 7. So we're really sure that it's not just a statistical fluctuation, but we can really reject the background-only hypothesis. And we were really able to do that. We are quite comfortable with that. So we claimed the observation of that process. Now we can do that for all kinds of processes. And this is summed up in this plot. This is some preliminary measurements as well included from the Atlas measurement. And this shows you some cross-section. We will talk about that in a minute. For all kinds of processes. So you always have the theory prediction in the gray bars compared to the orange bars, which gives you the measurement. And you can see very good agreement over a huge range of cross-sections. Note that the the y-axis is broken down. So this is you cannot really just count the ticks, but it really the orders of magnitude are a bit larger here. Coming back to the cross-section, so I told you that this is cross-section, this is a value we use in our theories, but you can translate it just to the probability of observing this process. If you divide your cross-section that you observed by the cross-section for the total proton-proton collisions. And that cross-section is shown here on the top left of that slide. And if you now look at only the process we're interested in, this is the one here on the bottom right side, and you just ignore the others for the moment, you just divide the two cross-sections by each other, and you see that this is a difference of 14 orders of magnitude. So we see that the process that we observed now has a probability of many zeros and then a one. So it's really 10 to the minus 14. This is also the reason why we need so many events, why we need to run the LHC for so long, because we need to at least have a handful of those events to really see what the detector tells us and to really see with statistical accuracy that this process exists. And we were able to do that for the first time here. Also, a bit further to the bottom right side, you see one that is even a bit further down there. We had also an observation there this year with a quite similar process. And I personally think this is a very nice plot to see how impressive this theory is, because you have predictions really over 14 orders of magnitude, and all of them are very, very well, and they all agree with data, and that is really nice to see. That sums up the main talking points of the talk. I would like to show you something else, and that is a screenshot of the public status display of the LHC a couple of weeks ago. Namely, 4 weeks ago, we ended our second major data-taking period. And over the next 2 years, we will upgrade our detector and the LHC as well to perform even better and to take even more data. And this gives you the opportunity to really go there, go to the LHC, and look at these machines. So if you're ever in the Geneva area, drop by, sign up for a guided tour, and try to see these detectors. It is really impressive. So in the interest of time, I will just leave you with some further links for further reading, and we would like to thank you for your attention.
That was wonderful. We have some time for questions. There's 4 microphones, 2 in the front and 2 in the back. So please queue up, and we're going to take 3 or 4 questions. First, we have a question from the internet.
Do you use some sort of deep learning algorithm to find the most interesting events?
For the event analysis, yeah, this is kind of the next step. So in the first step, I showed you that you first sum up just every event that you see. And then in the next step, you would look at each event to see what the actual kinematics are in there. And then kind of the next step would be to not only look at one observable, but to use multiple of those and combine them using deep learning or BDTs or any multivariate techniques. It's getting more common within Atlas. The problem is that you cannot really compare this to theory predictions. So if you want to look at the distribution, something like a BDT score or something, or the output of a neural net, you cannot calculate this without having the detector installed. So this doesn't really help theorists in comparing this to our measured data. It is really helpful in finding processes, so something like that could really benefit from finding the process, so claiming the observation. There we really need, we do multivariate techniques, but for kinematic distributions and so on, for comparing to the theory, it's not really helpful.
Thank you. Microphone number 3 in the back.
Hi. You could mention the open days in September for a specific date for visit?
There is no specific date. I mean, there's the period of 2 years now where the detectors are closed. And in principle, you can just go to the webpage that's shown here, visit.cern, and just sign up for a public tour. So they offer that. I think they offer the 1 year.
So as far as I know, they almost every day you can just drop them a line, and then you get sorted to a certain slot, and then you can just come and visit us. It's as easy as that.
Maybe yes. A bit in advance, not in the same
yes.
day.
Yes.
Thank you. Microphone number 1.
Thanks for this wonderful talk, first of all. I was wondering, so the last really big thing that we as a public heard from CERN was the discovery of the Higgs boson in 2012. And from what I heard, string theory is pretty much impossible to prove with those energies, and supersymmetry, well, from what I heard, you people have tried to prove supersymmetry for a while, and it seems to be pretty much impossible as well, so correct me if I'm wrong. So my question is, what next big question are you people at CERN working on?
If you don't want, I can. So
well, it's a huge question, right? So, yeah. As you saw already in the plot, we are doing many, many analyses, and we of course also still search for supersymmetry, but we also search for any kinds of exotic models, as we call them, like for example composite Higgs, where you imagine that exist other Higgs bosons that are made of even smaller particles that we have not yet found. So, yeah, in principle, we are searching for...
Yeah, we are still searching for all kinds of new physics. I mean, we're yeah. not only searching for supersymmetry. We could have found it already, but it wasn't there. So it's hard to disprove that it exists, but we didn't find any signs yet. But still, we have plenty of physics work ahead of us with the LHC and the existing standard model. So we have still quite a few measurements. You mentioned the Higgs boson, so for instance, we don't know how the Higgs boson interacts with all of the other particles. So we have still some work to do there. So we hope, we think we can keep ourselves busy over the next years as well. It would be nice to find some BSM things over the next years, but no signs that I know.
Even
of.
More interesting, if you don't know what you're looking for, then you can expect anything. And that's quite interesting to me as well, right?
Thank you. Apparently, people watching the stream are just raving about the talk, so we're going to take one more question from the internet people.
Do you have any idea if and how many interesting events you might have missed in the discarded data? And does discarded really mean thrown away for all time?
So that depends. For the discarded, if you mean the trigger, then if we didn't actually do the measurement in the detector, then obviously we cannot get this event back. So if the trigger didn't fire, then we don't have the event. From the, as I said, we have these random triggers that essentially, or the triggers that essentially give you random events to store that. As far as I know, Atlas hasn't really found anything there. That's not really our field of expertise.
I mean, we also take into account, so everything, every rejection, every selection has a certain efficiency, right? And also our trigger system has a certain efficiency. So that means you certainly miss some of the events that could have fallen into that trigger. But we can simulate this as well, and at least what we can simulate, we know what the efficiency is of our trigger, and we can correct for this.
Thank you. Microphone two.
Thank you for your talk. I have a question about your hypothesis test, because you said that you rejected the hypothesis that it's just background. So you could say, okay, there has to be something else. But could you say that your prediction is true? I mean, how do you handle this?
You can intrinsically never really say that this is the only possible explanation. So there are always other explanations that could give you the same result. That's intrinsically in science, you never can do that, so obviously we cannot do that as well. I hope that answers your question. So, yeah. But we can, I mean, you have to phrase it in a proper way, being that you can reject the background-only hypothesis with that certainty or that p-value or whatever, and that was six sigma or something, so the background-only is rejected. Should be, the signal model is consistent with what we see, so it is very consistent, but obviously we cannot say that this is the only explanation. I didn't hear that, sorry.
Okay. Thank you. One last question, microphone three, so make it count.
Okay, I just have one practical question. After the data is reduced, it's still very big. How do you transport the data to those who want to work further with it? Do you use internet? Do you use snail mail or smoke signals, something like that?
Well, the LHC has its own computing grid. This consists of the data center that I've just talked about, the one at CERN and also the one at Hungary. And then we this is the tier zero, and then we have 11 bigger data centers that are spread all over the world, where the data is transferred to and then also reconstructed. And so there are running several jobs over the whole world in these different data centers that we attach to this LHC grid, so to say.
And usually, if you're looking at that level where you have that, where you're starting to do the first physics selection, where you really need a cluster or something, then it's usually the case that we send the job to the data rather than using the data, downloading the data every time. So we can send our jobs to America and run them there, for instance, wherever the data is, and this is handled in our grid.
But obviously, this is why we do all of that physics selection, that we can reduce the amount of data that we actually need and to run that on our laptops or something that is obviously much more capable and much faster.
Thank you. Thank you for the amazing talk. And please give a round of applause, a huge round of applause.